Blog Talk Radio.
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. Give me 1 second here. I'm gonna switch up over here. I guess I'm gonna have to do it this way. How are you doing, Philip?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, sorry about the little confusion. We're having little technical difficulties, but at least we got to connect.
Yeah.
How's the album been going so far?
The album's going great. It's just just keep playing it and keep hearing it. I've played the songs so many times now that I could probably play them in my sleep.
it's interesting. The Pacific Northwest is, known for its music scene as well. I was talking to somebody from Pittsburgh last week and saying that, their scene is very interesting in terms of what they have availability. Obviously, there's a lot more availability for you to perform in the area. How's the local scene like for you to be able to perform?
Well, there's always venues. There's always places that'll take you on. A lot of that rich and vibrant music culture that, came up through, the early 90s and everything like that, a lot of that stuff still exists up here. And a lot of these venues have actually been around since then. And some famous artists have actually come through a lot of these venues up here. So the scene is actually still really good. And a lot of really cool, talented people that I like, schmoozing with when I play a venue. It's a great place to be a musician.
Yeah, it's great to be able to see that as well. Obviously, you can get the flavor of what's been going on in the area as well. You know, tell me a little bit about how you got started in music and, you know, some of your influences growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I got started in music at a young age. You know, I don't think people are able to really go through life if they have a passion for music. You know, I think it's tough for anybody to kind of really experience their first musical influence like much later in life. So I think most of us that love music and everything, I think most of us achieve that that inspiration at a very young age. And so, you know, my grandparents took me to church and I was listening to Elvis Presley gospel, and I would get home and my dad would turn on Pink Floyd. And so I, you know, I've got a bit of an eclectic musical background I still love to listen to all that stuff. Especially even Elvis Presley, you know, I think his birthday was just recent, and I've done a couple interviews now on radio programs where they've been talking about him. And so I have a bit of a connection with Elvis Presley. And, but you know, it's quite a different feeling going from church Elvis Presley to Van Halen at home, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the King's birthday was last week, well. And, you know, it's been interesting to hear quite a few of these, quite a few musicians say that, Elvis is still an influence. I mean, it's been so long since, the King passed away and he put out any music whatsoever. And it's been interesting to see that he has been kind of leaping the generations, as it were. It just goes to show you how timeless his music is.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, for Elvis, you know, I really experienced his musical breadth, I guess, when I heard. I took this history of rock and roll course when I was in college, and they played a song of his that I'd never heard before. His, you know, he was 18 years old when he recorded it. It was "That's All Right, Mama," and I just was blown away by his range of music style. You know, he was able to sing the blues. He was also able to sing gospel, and he was just a fantastic artist. He loved what he did, and he was really, really, really talented at it.
Yeah, and he had the ability to change. I mean, you should look at modern artists like Madonna, who always seemed to change throughout her career. And you know, a lot of modern musicians nowadays, you know, almost change on a dime almost. And back then, I mean, you would spend a couple years on one style, and then maybe something happened where you changed it up. I mean, Elvis, for example, I mean, he was doing more of the rockabilly early on, and he got into the gospel and a little bit more of the country later on. So It's interesting. It's interesting to say the least to you know, kind of develop yourself as an artist and to see that transition. I mean, obviously with you being an artist as well, from when you started to now, there has been a little bit of a transition between what you may have started out with and what you're doing now.
Yeah, when I first started playing guitar, I was really into Green Day and NoFX and punk music, and so you know that was what I was learning on my guitar early on. And it's pretty simple music to play. But, you know, as I've gotten older, I've progressed into the wanting to play more Jimi Hendrix-esque blues style. And, I'm really into John Mayer and, play some of these more complex songs that are from a different, much different genre than what I started out at. So, yeah, our musical tastes do change over time. And I was trying to think of artists that maybe hadn't changed, you know, and still were popular throughout the years. And I don't think I can't really name any, because even Eric Clapton, you know, he was part of the rock trio, you know, Cream. And, you know, as he migrated out into solo career, he got way more into, you know, playing blues, like through, you know, like Robert Johnson style blues. And things like that. It was a bit more mild. And then, you know, he even had pop hits, you know, like Tears in Heaven and Old Love and stuff like that. So, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, now, it's a very interesting story in terms of how you started with the guitar as well. I mean, tell me a little bit, tell my audience a little bit about that story, about how you ended up, getting into guitar and slowly start working with that.
Yeah, my dad brought me home a guitar, and it was, you know, like one of the cheap $99 Walmart guitars. And I remember I kind of tried to, I wasn't sure it was for me. It was in the back of his truck or back of his SUV. And, I picked it up and I was, you know, playing with the strings a little bit. And I don't know, something just came over me and I just fell in love with the instrument, and so I asked him, you know, if I could play it, and he said that's, you know, that was the reason he bought it, so why not? And so I fell in love with the instrument. It's such a versatile way of playing music, and you know, you can get some of the craziest sounds out of an electric guitar, and you've got a multitude of pedals that you can add to it, and not to mention the fact that it's small and it's easy to carry around. You know, like if I was going to play piano, you know, it's tough to take a baby grand piano everywhere you go. So yeah, the guitar just, it made sense in my head, and I guess I was never bad at it, so that was a plus.
Now, was the guitar an electric guitar or an acoustic?
It was an electric guitar. I started out playing electric guitar.
That's interesting. It's interesting, the electric guitar. I mean, especially considering what you can do with it. Like I said, you can do different things with the, different features with it as well. And tune it and all that as well. It's been interesting, to say the least, in terms of how the technology has come up with the guitar. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that as well. I mean, from that guitar up to what you probably play now, you know, you're probably seeing a lot more adjustments that you can find on a guitar or whatever. I mean, how is it for you to kind of select a guitar nowadays? And, you know, is it just something that, something that you just have to go through? There's certain things that you look for in a guitar.
Actually, I let the guitar choose me when I purchase a new one. It's a weird feeling, and I don't know if anybody out there has experienced this, but there are certain instruments that just don't fit. You know, I've played guitars that I was like, yeah, that's fine. I've played some expensive guitars too. There was like a $10,000 12-string guitar that I played that I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, this is not for me. You know, I wouldn't pay that much for a guitar, but, it just wasn't for me. I didn't feel it. But then, you know, I went and there's a white Fender Stratocaster with a maple neck that is my favorite. And, you know, I picked that up and I played it for the first time, and I couldn't put it down. It was just this weird feeling that the guitar was made for me. And, I think a lot of guitar players, at least serious guitar players, feel that way too. I've had a conversation with quite a few, and I think quite a few of them feel the same way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, obviously comfort and all that as well. I mean, and sometimes even the look as well. One question I like to ask, a lot of musicians, and a lot of females, you know, have no answer for this. I think only one that had an answer for this, but. Oh, with the males, they always tend to see to have an answer. But have you named your guitars at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they're all named after – my electrics are all named after my electrics are all named after women. one of my guitars is named Allison, and it's after she was a character on my favorite TV show, Mad Men. She was the main character's secretary, and I just always thought she was beautiful, and it fit. I was really into Mad Men at the time, and so I named this guitar that, and then, you know, it just stuck. I ended up, you know, putting the name on the guitar itself, and yeah, I name all my guitars. Every single one of them has a name.
I mean, it's interesting because I said I ask a lot of the female musicians and they never name their instruments. It's kind of interesting,
I think there's an explanation for that. You know, this is not to sound sexist by any stretch of imagination, but there was a comedian that told a joke. He said men will write the most beautiful song about a woman. He will sing about every aspect of her, you know, of her being and how she is just an angel from heaven itself. And women will write that same exact song about shoes.
Yeah, but yet they don't name their shoes. The shoes are already named.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting to say the least, like I said. I mean, tell me a little bit about the process that you go through in terms of songwriting. Is it sometimes that you have a melody in your head and and you come up with lyrics, that sometimes the lyrics come to you and you write, or is it a little combination of both?
You know, it's a combination of both, but a lot of times what happens is I'll start off with a topic. I write songs the same way I used to write papers in college, is I'll start with a topic and then I'll kind of work backwards. And I usually have some riffs and melodies that I've been using for a while that really don't fit anywhere. And I'll try and pair them with certain lyrics and everything. And then usually a song kind of develops out of that.
Yeah. Then what's nice, and I talked to a lot of musicians about this as well. I mean, what's nice is that you have phones around now that you can write down stuff as well. And
right.
Do you ever find yourself like recording into your phone, maybe a melody or something like that, if you don't have a guitar handy or something like that?
Always. Yeah. I'll just hum it into my, I've got a songwriting app on my phone and I'll just hum it right into my phone. And I like that. I like the way technology has helped me write songs. It's hurt me in a lot of ways, but it helps me a lot too.
Now, it was interesting because you went into the military, you were overseas. So you kind of, I won't say lost your passion, but you didn't pursue it as much when you were in the military. Then you heard John Mayer's CD and you picked it up again.
Right.
I mean, did you have a guitar with you, or was that something that you kind of ended up picking up again? I know sometimes the military takes a while for, you know, if you move a lot, especially you have to, you have to pack light. But did you have a guitar with you initially, and did you end up bringing it with you?
Yeah, I did have a guitar with me, and actually it was an acoustic that my dad bought me right before he died. Actually, it was just a really, really, you know, cheaper acoustic, and it meant a lot to me. It had a lot of sentimental value because my dad bought it for me, but some chief I had accidentally dropped a speaker on it and snapped the headstock on it, and I wasn't able to play for almost an entire deployment, and so that was pretty frustrating, especially because the chief wouldn't take responsibility, I was pretty broken by that. That was pretty frustrating. I took a guitar with me everywhere I could when I was in the military. Circumstances can sometimes often make it difficult to bring it with you everywhere you want to go. But yeah, most of the time I did.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously you have an audience there, you know, you've got, you know, fellow military guys that'll probably listen to you play and all that as well, which is always fun. It's always kind of, you know, it's always kind of boring. I won't say boring, but you know, it's kind of, just playing by yourself is something, you know, something different than maybe doing it in front of a couple people at least, you know. And then
right.
I hear, you know, people sometimes like a little bit more intimate setting versus maybe a stadium setting as well. I mean, do you have a preference in terms of that?
Yeah, the intimate setting, definitely. With a house concert or something like that, you know, you can pack 30 people into a small little setting like that and just play to a group of people, and people aren't sitting there jammering away at the mouth like they do at a bar or something like that, you know, and people are usually pretty respectful in small settings like that. So I definitely have a preference of that over. But you know what? If I was selected to play at the Gorge Amphitheater here in Washington, I wouldn't turn it down.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because, like I said, some people talk about, you know, the idea of having a bigger stage just so they can move around a little bit more versus just, you know, being very sedentary. In a kind of an intimate setting like that. So there's always that kind of, you know, that kind of, it's interesting to hear, you know, some people actually do like bigger stages as well. So, it just depends on how you kind of perform and all that as well. Let's talk a little bit about the album. I mean, obviously a couple of, you just released a couple of tracks as well. How was it for you to kind of put this out? Was this your first album?
So this is actually my second, but it's, you know, I put out an album back in 2011. The only song that actually made it, that went from that album to this one, was the song Drowning. I don't know if you've heard it, but there was a studio version of the song Drowning that actually I only have like a few copies of that album, and the record label went out of business. And so like it's pretty tough to find now, but this would be my first, I guess, breakthrough album, I guess. That one didn't go anywhere, and it was mostly for charity, the previous one.
Yeah, and the thing was is that, I mean, you know, did you and that was probably your first studio experience, right?
Now, this one was not my first studio experience. The previous one was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, how was it for you to be in the studio for the first time, that first time, and to be able to to see how an album is made, and how has that helped you in terms of this album, when you went to the studio for a second time, and did you learn a lot from that first experience?
Yeah, you know, being in the studio can seem a bit intimidating, especially because you sit down and they're, you know, the clock's running. They go record, and you do. And, you know, it gets even more intimidating when they play a sample of you singing without any music behind you. And you're sitting there listening to your own voice. And I don't know about anybody else, but I know my own voice makes me cringe when I hear it. So, you know, there's that experience there. And so the whole experience with a studio can actually be very intimidating for a lot of people. My studio now that I work with is actually pretty fantastic. And I don't feel that anymore. I feel pretty relaxed when I go in there. And the most important aspect of that is that I trust them. They're really experienced at what they do. And I trust them not to, I guess I trust them to make things sound the best they can. They do good recordings over there.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, huge music scene out in Seattle. I mean, this album was produced in the Seattle area, right?
I beg your pardon?
The album was recorded there in Seattle, right?
It was.
Yeah, so yeah, like I said, big music scene, so there's a lot of great studios in the area as well. I mean, you know, was there any certain reason why you selected this studio?
This studio, you know, is actually word of mouth. You know, we when I was playing guitar with another band, which was just kind of a side project, we did some recording through this specific studio, and just the whole experience was actually pretty interesting and really laid back, and you know, it felt good, and the recordings came out great. So I contacted him again when I started working on my own stuff, and yeah, like I said, I wasn't too surprised that he did a really, really good job, the studio engineer.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, this album, I mean, it's great to be able to see, you know, have a, you know, a few tracks on there as well. You know, what kind of went into selecting some of the songs that you did for this album, and were there some tracks that you maybe you know, held on to maybe for a later album?
Yeah, so there's a song I'm holding on to. It's called In the Deep End, and I'm holding on to that one because I really want to get a full band behind it instead of just an acoustic EP. The songs were picked typically through people telling me that you should record that one. You know, and there was about 30 songs that I had written, and I whittled them down into about five, and or into about six, and then I cut one for budget reasons. But you know, it's I think we picked the right ones. Well, my opinion.
Yeah. Now, you know, sorry to hear that your father and your grandfather had passed. You know, relatively in a short amount of time between each other. I mean, you know, how has that helped you, inspire you to kind of pursue this a lot more further? And you know, tell me a little bit about their influences.
So, I missed the beginning part of that question. You were breaking up a little bit.
Oh, I was mentioning that, you know, your father and your grandfather had passed.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. What kind of influences do they have in terms of, you know, you pursuing this music?
Yeah. So yeah, they did pass relatively close to one another, and it indirectly influences the songwriting process, because there's definitely times I'm sadder than others about this, because you know, it's been 14 years since I lost my dad, and you know, 13 years since I lost my grandfather, but I don't think any of that pain ever really goes away, and I think songwriting is a good outlet for that. So you know, there'll be times I'm frustrated or sad or something like that, and I'll sit down and I'll pen some lyrics and I'll feel better. And, you know, if I can share that with someone else, if they can experience what I experienced through song, then I think I've done my job. I think that's my desire when it comes to songwriting anyway, is I try to produce the same feelings in other people that I have felt when I've listened to certain songs. And, you know, if somebody reaches out and tells me that one of my songs has helped them, which they have told me that, that one of the songs has helped them get through a really rough patch in their life, then, you know, I feel like I get a lot of internal satisfaction from that.
Yeah, speaking of which, I mean, obviously the fans can give you feedback on, I believe you have a Twitter, I think it's at Real Philip Brew, right, Bro, right?
I'm sorry?
Your Twitter.
Yeah, at Real, yeah, I couldn't fit my whole last name on there, so it's just at Philip, B-R-O-U.
Yeah, and then, yeah, I mean, and then Facebook as well, you know, Philip Broussard, and, you know, like you said, you know, get a lot of that, you're getting a lot of that that feedback from the audience as well. So, and then I believe your album is available currently on iTunes and Amazon and SoundCloud. I'm assuming.
It is.
Okay, so make sure you guys check that out as well. Are you playing any? Are you playing any local? Are you playing any gigs over the next couple weeks?
I am, and you'll be able to find those out on Facebook. I post those routinely.
Okay, so yeah, make sure you guys check that out if you're in the Seattle area as well. Love to have you down here and play a concert or two, so maybe
that'd
that'll
awesome.
Happen in some zip. So anything else you want to add? Anything else you need to promote?
No, I definitely appreciate coming on your show. I love doing these radio interviews. I like to keep in touch with the host too over time, so please don't hesitate to reach out to me again.
Oh, not at all, Philip. And like I said, it'll be interesting to see how your career goes in the rest of this year. You know, obviously with the new EP out and all that as well. So hope you get to tour out a little bit more outside of Washington area. So
yeah, I agree.
You know, best of luck to you in this 2018, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thank you again for having me. It was an honor and a privilege.
No problem, Philip. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Bye. Okay, that was Philip Broussard, everybody. Give me one second. I'm going to get my little call up. And okay. And I'm sorry about the little bit of squeaking, but I had to flip over to my other car, which is a very funny comedian. And he actually was in Seattle for a while, but originally from Hawaii. He's going to be over at the Brad Garrett Comedy Club coming up this weekend. Kermit, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. How's everything going?
Everything is great. Love being down here in Vegas. Having a good time so far.
Yeah, I mean, out of the smoke and out of the mudslides that are out in California, I'm assuming. So, you've been here probably quite a few times before. I mean, and I think you've been, have you been to the Brad Garrett before?
This is about, I want to say my sixth or seventh time working at Brad's, and I'm just thrilled that they always have me back.
Yeah, it's a really nice venue. I always say this at Brad's, that Brad had really thought about how to make the venue very comic friendly, very few clubs can say that. You know, sometimes you get stuck in, sometimes they're not even comedy clubs, they're just bars that happen to have a stage. But, it's great to be able to see the Brad had such a great venue out here. So it's great to be able to see that as well.
Really is a beautiful venue. And for comics, it's just set up so well. There's not a bad seat. You know, everybody has good sight lines to you, and the sound and lights and the low ceilings. It's just really designed the way a comedy club should be designed.
Yeah. Now, you know, you're originally from Hawaii, and there's a huge Hawaiian population out here as well. I mean, have you been seeing a lot of Hawaiians out there at your show?
Not as much at the show. I have relatives here and friends from high school, and there's a lot of Hawaiians here. We've seen a few. I think there was about three last night. So, and that's kind of about what it is. You know, we'll get a few here and there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, to say the least, about that. It is a little bit of a it's a little bit different comedy scene here than it is in LA, because I hear from a lot of comedians that this is more of a cross section out here, because there's tourists coming in and all that as well. LA, you know, tends to have a very strong, you know, comedy crowd, but they tend to be locals. How's it been for you to be able to perform out here and kind of get your licks in out here and have a little bit of a different crowd than you may have in LA?
Yeah, well, actually, I live in Seattle, so I'm the same as Phillips, so I'm usually in front of that market. but I do travel all over, and I have done a lot of cruise ships. I do about 5 or 6 cruise ship runs a year, and so I'm kind of familiar with that audience that's sort of from everywhere. And so what you try and do is you try and relate on some level that can at least connect to people. So you try and be less specific about locations or stores or you know, things that might be specific to an area, and you try and kind of talk about the more relatable things, you know, the things that sort of connect.
Yeah, you know, and that's very important if you want to make it on the national scene, just to have that under your belt. You know, I mean, if you know, you look at some of the major comedians that are out there, they have to be able to connect to a wide audience. So it's always nice to get those, you know, get those licks in and try to incorporate as much as you possibly can. Now it's interesting. The Seattle scene is very interesting, and it's kind of almost the hub of the Northwest, where, you know, you're getting a lot of comedians from the Northwest that do go to Seattle in order to kind of get their licks in before maybe making the big move to LA or New York or something like that. How is the scene out there in Seattle, and is there a lot of comedy clubs out there?
There are a few comedy clubs up there, but it is a great scene. There's you know, a couple of hundred comics, I think, from every level, from early open micers to headliners. There's a lot of comedians, and you're right, a lot of comedians have been coming down from Seattle to LA or New York, and actually are doing very well right now. It's been great to see the people who kind of got their chops in Seattle and kind of make their way to the bigger stuff. It's a pretty live scene. I think I think Seattle has about 3 comedy clubs, and Portland has 1. So, both cities have a lot of these comic run rooms where comedians will put together a show, and just to get people stage time and to get comedy out there. So there's a lot of comedy run rooms as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, sometimes you have to kind of almost make your own room in order to be able to get there, even if there isn't a club. So, it's interesting to say the least. A lot of crossover. So I'm assuming there would be a lot of crossover in Portland as well. I mean, there's a lot of coffee houses that could easily just do, one comedy night a week or something like that. So,
that's right. There's a lot of these different gigs at coffee houses or small bars, you know, that they're only going to do it once a week or once every other week, or even other places that will do an open mic every week where nobody gets paid, but you get to, you know, new people get stage time and working comics get to try out new stuff. And yeah, there's a lot of different ways to present comedy to people.
Yeah. I mean, tell me, audience, a little bit about how you got started in comedy and how you ended up doing comedy a little bit more often.
I was a fan of comedy. You know, when I was a kid, if I had a good week and I behaved or whatever, my parents would let me stay up on Friday night and watch Johnny Carson. I mean, I was a really big fan of comedy, and I never thought I'd do it. But when I was working at United Airlines after college, and there was a guy who did comedy. He would do open mic and occasionally get paid gigs, but he worked at the same department, and that's kind of how it started. I hung out with him at open mic a couple of times, and then the third time he asked me, do you want me to sign you up? And I was so scared, but I said, all right, I'll give it a try. And I started, you know, doing open mic and having so much fun, and not really thinking that I'm going to do this for a living, but thinking, well, I get to hang out with these comedians, with these odd, weird, funny people. I just like being around them. And so it was a great hobby. And then all of a sudden, I think when I was 23, I decided to take a chance at it. But really, I kind of thought that I'd do it for a couple of years, and then at 25, I'd grow up. I'd become an adult, you know? But I'd always have that story that for 2 years or whatever I was a touring comedian. I was, you know, I could always have that story no matter what happens. And that was 27 years ago, I think. Yeah, 27 years ago. And I honestly thought it's just going to be something I do for a couple of years before I become an adult.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, sometimes it just falls into your lap and things happen, you know, where those opportunities end up happening. I mean, like I said, Seattle was still a growing scene, I think, probably when you started in terms of the comedy scene as well. I mean, you know, how was it for you to start out in the scene back then? Obviously, there's a lot more opportunities now, but, you know, how was it for you to kind of start out, when the scene was really starting to build.
Yeah, the scene was really in a boom back then, and but there were a lot fewer comics, and technology has really changed it. You know, now you can go online and YouTube, and you can see a lot of how open mic works, and you can figure out a lot about open mic and about comedy itself long before you ever try it. back then we couldn't. Back then we had to. You know, you had to find open mics, what clubs they were at, and comedy clubs didn't really advertise their open mics. So you had to kind of find out where they were, what time you had to sign up, and then you'd go in and try it. So there was a lot more effort in it. But the great thing was that clubs were thriving at the time. I mean, there were comedy clubs all over the place. So if you got in with a certain amount of clubs, you could get a lot of stage time and a lot of really good stage time in front of, you know, good audiences with a good crowd, good clubs and everything. So it was really different. I don't know if I started today if I'd have enough stage time to get good enough to go on the road.
Yeah, and you know, the fact is that, you know, with the technology as well, the fact that you can reach out to owners a lot easier than maybe when you did earlier. I heard from several comedians that were saying, you know, in the old days, I mean, you had to send, you know, sometimes even VHS tapes of your stuff to these these club owners or whatever, and they have to, you know, hurry up and wait and see what happens. Nowadays they can just go online and click on it and see your sets and see, oh, I like that person, I can hire them now. I wouldn't mind hiring them at all. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and it's interesting that the way that comedy has evolved with the technology as well. I mean, it's very interesting as well. You know, it's been a little bit easier on you because you're from Seattle. I mean, obviously, if LA, you could be there in person, or if you wanted to do some clubs around there, you could do it there. But you'd have to be down there in order to do it. So, with the technology, obviously, you know, a little bit easier for you to be able to take some of these gigs that are out of state.
Yeah, it's you know, to be able to be established as a working comic, you know. For a lot of years, it does give me a bit of a chance to kind of get on stage at certain places. But you're right. If you start in a certain city now, it's really hard to get stage time, to get recognized. You have to be really, really good, because like I said, in Seattle, there's a couple hundred people doing comedy on all the different levels. And that's a lot of competition for stage time, because there aren't a couple of hundred sets to be had around Seattle on the week, you know? So it's very competitive.
Now, you know, with that, I mean, you know, how has it been with your writing? Obviously, you know, you continually writing and updating your sets as well. I mean, do you keep a lot of notebooks around, or, you know, obviously digital age, you might be writing them down on your iPhone or whatever, but, you know, how's it for you to be able to write, and do you ever go back to some of those old jokes, you know, that, you know, you feel that maybe it's topical now that, you know, may not have been topical then?
Yeah, or something that you just couldn't come up with a punchline for. I have a lot of things like that that I jot down and didn't work, or maybe either I tried it and didn't work, or I just knew it wasn't going to work, and I left it in the notebook. And then you revisit it 2-3 years later, and you think, oh wait, I think I have an idea for a punchline, or a punchline comes to you and you go, oh, that could be for that thing I used to do. But as far as my process, it's I still have the notebooks. I'm still kind of old school that way, but I write the concepts, the ideas down on my phone, you know, my notes, the note thing on my phone. I'll just I'll put little phrases and then maybe ideas for punchlines that I might have for it. And then use those to decipher what I'm working on right now. But then when it comes to actually writing the bit and trying stuff on the bit, then I actually go back to notebooks. And yeah, it's really old school, man, pen to paper kind of stuff. But I started comedy in the 90s, so that's how I'm used to doing it.
Yeah, now with you know, with that in mind, I mean, how's it for you to you know, when you go into a room, you know, I know some comedians just, you know, kind of are able to gauge the audience as well. If you're an opener, you can't really gauge the audience off of what you know, what goes before you, because you're the first person on the stage and all that as well. It's usually one of the tougher spots. But you know, how is it for you in your process? You know, do you like to, you know, kind of gauge the audience that way you can kind of adjust in terms of your set?
Yeah. So if I'm not the first person on stage, I do. I listen to kind of what they're laughing at and how they're reacting. But if I am early on, you know, on the show, then basically what I do is I script out about the first 4 minutes, 5 minutes, and just to kind of have an idea that where they are. And those first 4 or 5 minutes sort of have a different variety of jokes to see kind of which jokes kind of hit the hardest of those. And that kind of tells me where they are for the rest of the show. But I'm a big proponent of getting to know the audience before you get up there. I really believe that's a valuable tool in comedy. It's pretty impressive that you mentioned that, because that to me is something that a lot of comics don't realize. You really need to study the audience and who they are, because they're all different. You know, we've had just in the two shows I've done here at Brad so far, we've had two very different audiences, both good, but Monday was amazing, right? Monday was right with you on everything. And then last night was a little harder work. You had to kind of plug away at it, to kind of get at it. And so, yeah, audiences are different. And so you gotta know. And for me, if I can't do it by watching another comedian, then I'll do it by my first 5 minutes.
Yeah, it you have to be adaptable on stage. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes comedians will take improv classes just so they can have that mental ability to be able to adapt. You know, in case something happens, you know. So that's probably the one thing that a lot of young comics need to understand too, is the fact that you have to be adaptable in order to know, you know, if something's going wrong. If something's going wrong, you're obviously going to be bombing. And you know, the great comedians always know that if they're bombing, then they know how to get out of that. And I mean, part of that is just doing reps, you know, going to different places, you know, to take, you know, taking some of the not traditional circuits, you know, the, you know, right out here in the Northwest there's a circuit, up there in the Northwest there's a circuit, you know, and all that as well. And in the Midwest there's a circuit, you know, and sometimes you got to kick those reps, you know.
Yes.
If you don't take those reps, you're not going to be a great comedian. I'm pretty sure there was times when you had a, you know, really some interesting stories about going out, you know, in the middle of nowhere and doing a show.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you first start going on the road, you're not good enough for anybody to fly you anywhere. So I ran two cars into the ground, trying to do comedy, because you're just driving anywhere somebody will hire you. And then the other thing is, you know, I grew up in Hawaii and I learned how to drive in the winter. I learned how to drive in snow, because if you don't make it to the gig, you won't get paid. So I remember some really harrowing drives where it's, you know, snow is just falling like crazy, but I'm trying to get to a certain town. It is a long road. And then you start getting to the point where you get better gigs, and all of a sudden you're flying to gigs, and it really does you appreciate it a lot, because those bar gigs, you know, across the highway, man, those can be really tough gigs and really tough travel as well.
Yeah, nowadays, I mean, air travel has actually gotten a little bit cheaper. Especially if you're in a major hub like Seattle, I mean, you can find direct flights from Seattle to Las Vegas, or Seattle to Los Angeles, or you know anywhere that's a major hub. So it's always, you know, it's always nice to be able to do that as well. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like I said, being that way as well. I mean, how's it been for you to have Seattle as a home base? I mean, are you on the road a lot, or do you stay in the Seattle area a lot of the time?
I'm on the road about half the time. My daughter's 15 now. When she was born, I kind of made the decision to not go on the road as much, and it's actually worked out better, because I made myself available for better types of gigs, like corporates, where you fly out, you do the show, and then you fly back the next day. And so I'm about maybe half the time, a little less than half the time, which is about right for me. I think there's a sanity preservation in that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, have you done any gigs out in Hawaii at all?
Yes. Yeah. I do occasionally. I'll do a cruise ship out there, and then occasionally I'll do a big show. You know, I'm lucky. I have a lot of friends and family and stuff. And so when I put the word out, they do sort of tell people about it. So I have this sort of cool advertising network that's just through, you know, through people I know. So the shows are fun there, and I can usually do pretty well numbers wise.
Well, I mean, that's great to hear as well. I mean, you know, like I said, out here, it kind of be interesting to see a little more Hawaiians out to your show, because I'm pretty sure that you get the audience for that out here. I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy, especially when the University of Hawaii comes in to face UNLV in football.
It's
a crazy time.
I know a lot of people come up for that, and like I said, I have friends and relatives here, and it's there's a really great. Come here, and then you go into some of the in some areas. You go into like a drugstore, and there's Hawaiian stuff, at in the aisles. It's really amazing to see here.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's great to see here as well. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, definitely interesting life as well. I mean, you know, I'm going to be at the Garrett this week. And then how long are you out here for? I think I know you're out here for this week, or just out here for this week.
Yes, through Sunday night, and one show every night, 8 o'clock, and it's with two very funny comedians, Stephen Thomas from L.A. and Rocky Laporte from Chicago, who is amazing. Rocky's one of my favorites, a very nice guy and hilariously funny, so it's a fun show.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like I said, the Garrett's a really great venue in terms of comedy. You got to go out and see the venue and see Kermit do his gig. As well, I mean, are you out on social media at all?
Yes. Basically, most of my social media is just my name. It's Kermetapio, Kermit Apio, and that's my Twitter handle @KermitApio, Face Kermit Apio, YouTube Kermit Apio. The only thing that's different is my website is ikerm.com. I heard Philip talking earlier that he couldn't fit his whole name to get a Twitter handle. And what I realized is that my name is misspelled a lot. So just I would have had to buy a lot of domain names to get people to link back to my name because it's misspelled. So I just went with ikerm.com for my website.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense too. I was looking up, you know, your website when I was booking the show today, and you know, it made a lot of sense to me. With the website as well. So, definitely check that out as well. I mean, are you going to be recording any comedy albums or any specials at all, or is that something that you may be looking to do down the line?
No, I just did a special for a company called Dry Bar Comedy. They do a really nice job, and it's a 40-minute special. If you go to their website and look me up, there's a 40-minute special on there. And what they do is it costs $1 to watch the specials, and they have a ton of comedians up there, and these are really fun shows. But if people don't mind spending $1 to see what I do, it's up there as well. Or like you said, I'll be at Brad Garrett's all week.
So yeah, definitely check that out as well. You know, a good friend of mine, Adam Hunter, who's been a guest on the show, I know he's taping his special up in Seattle, I believe either this week or next. Definitely interesting. It'll be great to read for me. If I can get out there, I will try to get out there this year to see you, Corinne. If not, I will try to get you the next time you're at the Brad Garrett. And anything else you want to promote? Anything you need to add?
No, I think you covered it all, and I can't thank you enough for having me on. Man, it's really great to talk to you and to be on, and I really do appreciate it.
And not a problem, Kermit, and definitely, have a kick-ass 2018. We'll try to get a hold of you later Maybe we'll interview you a little bit later this year if you end up being at the Red Garrett again.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
No problem, Kermit. You have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Yep. That was Kermit Appio, everybody. You guys can check out iKerm.com. You guys can check out his social media as well, Kermit Appio. That's K-E-M-E-T. APIO. So guys, check out that as well. We'll talk to I should have a couple guests next week. I will let you guys know. It'll be on our regular time on Monday. Like I said, we had a little bit of snafu on Monday that I couldn't make the show, so we pushed everything today. So we'll be back on Monday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. I'll probably have it posted on the website tonight or tomorrow who we'll have on Monday's show. But like I said, we're trying to keep this thing going as well. So we'll probably have two guests on. I have one that I'm pretty sure it's on the hook, and then we'll have another guest as well. So we'll have that announcement on tomorrow. Please follow us on Twitter at SWIB, and Somewhere in Vegas on Facebook. You guys can check us out as well. With that in mind, we'll talk to you guys this coming Monday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for joining us.